main source of hatred in the world is religion. And organized religion.
These Christian apologists are full of intolerance and expecting us to swallow it, but I'm not allowing this. First, they claim this is a Christian nation and then proceed to try to merge their little doctrine into biased legislation. Like we should give a damn about the God they praise or their book of contradictions written back in the days. Some mythological, hypocritical bullshit that tends to distort shit, and then you wonder why we all ignore this. You're atheists to each and every other type of God. For all you know, the one you worship it could be the fraud. Yeah, I know, we're taking it out of context. That's what you would say next.
You are listening to The Skeptic Hour. I'm your host, Doubting Thomas. It's February 20th, 2011. I'm here along with co-host R.W., the Rational Warrior.
How's it going, guys?
All right. We'll be interviewing Nate Phelps today. Nate Phelps is a former member of the Westboro Baptist Church. He does a lot of speaking out about his experiences. Are you with us, Nate?
I'm here.
Okay. We'll be discussing your upbringing in the Westboro Baptist Church. We're both Kansans here, and yeah. I'm from Kansas City, and I understand you were raised in Topeka, Kansas.
Yeah, that's right. 18 okay. years there.
18 years?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing? I find it fascinating, and it's very encouraging because... Yeah. You were right there in the belly of the beast, and you escaped that. And there's a lot of people out there who have questions who maybe don't have it as bad as you had it growing up, but you still made it through. I find it very encouraging. Can you give us a little bit of insight on how it was growing up in that family, in that church?
Well, as you might imagine, there was constant focus on my father's idea of what the Bible taught, that, you know, very literal, rigorous, what I call hyper-Calvinist theology. From the time, literally from the day we were born, we sat in those pews and listened to him expound on those doctrines. And in addition to that, he was just, you know, it was a very violent environment, physically and emotionally and otherwise. So that was one of the components that I believe served the purpose of keeping the people there committed to, fearful of leaving that situation because of, you know, the violence that could be visited on them, both from their earthly father as well as from their notion of who God was.
Okay. And what was it that made you begin to question this? How did you, was your father always like this growing up? Is this what you remember from day one, or was there a point that this began?
No, this is what I remember from day one, and as far as I can tell from the stories that we heard, you know, when we got a little bit older, this is the way he was from the moment he received the calling, if what he calls an unction from the Holy Spirit when he was at a revival meeting in Mississippi, where he was born and raised. And I think he was 17 when that happened. So he hasn't deterred from this particular theological path, you know, for all those years. He's just kind of gotten more intense, more focused, more exclusionary as far as the way he interprets those passages.
Nate, this is R.W. One of the questions I really wanted to ask you was, while I was preparing for the show, I did a little research on your father, and I found out that at one time he was a civil rights attorney. How did his religious principles, did they conflict in any way with his civil rights work? Because if I would just figure if he, you know, had some sort of ill will towards, if he has ill will towards homosexuals, did that translate as well into other groups?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's interesting to me because when people ask that or want to talk about that, oftentimes they see a dichotomy there where he's so disinclined to consider equal rights for homosexuals, while on the other hand he was in the thick of fighting for equal rights for blacks in America.
Yeah.
And, it just doesn't seem contradictory to me at all because I know what I saw growing up there. Mm-hmm. You know, he was born and raised in the Deep South. He carried with him very strong learned bias against blacks. Mm-hmm. But he was also very good as an attorney, and he was always inclined towards doing stuff that would upset people, that he would get criticized for. So it fit very nicely for him to, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 came along. It was pretty much an empty shell.
Right, right.
Federal legislation, and it was a beautiful opportunity for him. He was just, hitting his stride as far as his legal work, and there it was, and he took it and ran with it, and quite frankly did a brilliant job of it there for 8 or 10 years, won some big cases, helped define that federal legislation in very specific terms. But that doesn't say anything about his own personal ideology and his religious ideology. He taught us from behind the pulpit that the black race was cursed because of one of the sons of Noah. I'm sure you guys know that story.
Ham.
Right. Yeah, Ham. Yeah. It isn't inconsistent with he basically has picked found a reason for every group, every individual outside of that church.
Wow.
For why they're going to hell. And blacks are definitely not exempt from that in his theology.
Right.
So yeah, one doesn't have to do with the other in my mind.
Okay. And how many of, now you're one of the estranged sons of them, but I understand there's a few others who have left. Out of your siblings, how many still remain in the church?
Well, I have an older brother who left before me, and then a younger sister who left after I did. And then my older sister, Catherine, is kind of in an odd place. She left, came back, left again, came back again. But at some point, the decision was made that she wasn't one of God's elect. So although she attends that church regularly and teaches her own version of that same hateful theology, she's not considered a member of that, so she's ostracized from her family as well.
Wow. Wow. Are you still in contact with any of your siblings?
Well, when I left when I was 18, I was in a relationship, or had a relationship, I should say, with my brother, and we ended up running a printing company for over 20 years out in Southern California. Started it in Overland Park there. And then had one in Topeka for a time, but eventually moved to Southern California. So we were together, working together in business for over 20 years. And then Dortha, I've just recently been able to start having a relationship with long distance because she's in Topeka still.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a fairly close relationship there now.
That's good. What was the catalyst that had you to the point where you started to doubt the things that your father was teaching? Like, was it, did you see something on television? Was it somebody you came in contact with, or was it just his overall treatment of the family that caused you to find the inconsistent behavior in his actions?
Yeah, but that's never an easy question to answer, you guys, because I think it's a lot of components. I have grown up believing that it was just that I was at odds with him because I didn't trust him because he was so violent, so I kept my distance. I kind of treated him like he was a mad dog as far as how I interacted with him,
Right.
But when I, by the time I was 8, 9, 10 years old, I started looking at the world and, through the lens that he told us to look at it through, as well as through, the lens of, the general public. And it just didn't make sense to me that we were, it isn't that we were just, part of a large group, what you would call Christians, and that we were lucky enough to have been selected. God picked us, was what we thought, and he picked just us. So I'm thinking to myself, if in fact that's true, then, you know, it was a fairly juvenile perception, but it was, the idea was that, you know, we should almost be glowing.
Right.
Does that make sense? I mean, there should be something so profoundly unique about us that it would be obvious to, you know, anybody walking by, any observer. And in fact, we were just the opposite. We were, you know, living this kind of crass, bullying, disruptive, cruel existence in how we interacted with the rest of the world. And, you know, it just didn't make sense to me. And then I would listen to his explanation of, you know, some divine intervention causing this or that event, and I thought, well, you know, there's just really no evidence for that. It just happened because it happened, right?
Right, right.
So I think a part of it is just how my mind thought. Part of it was that I was at odds with this power source in my life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those and probably a dozen other things combined to create that inclination to be critical of his worldview.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Did he prepare you for the opposition? You know, Christianity kind of raises us to prepare for the opposition in the sense that everyone, you'll hear different things. You'll hear certain things about your religion that's not true, but it's the devil's influence. Did he kind of set you up that way and the rest of the kids?
He was and is a master at that, and that is a critical aspect of what holds people into that situation. And I know this because I fought it my entire adult life, because he systematically would identify some specific theology or idea that existed out there in the world, and he would dismantle it, and he would throw in a lot of these, you know, this language from the Bible that, you know, we have itching ears and that, you know, they went out from us because they weren't of us, and all of that rhetoric that you find in the Bible that is exclusive and inclusive, depending on whether you're with the program or not.
Right,
so
right.
What ends up happening there is every time you go out there and do a deliberate job of looking for evidence or searching for the facts of the situation, you're left with this sense of uneasiness or guilt or, you know, like you're doing the devil's work, or that you aren't spiritual enough, that's your motivation, that it isn't okay for people to go out and search for the truth beyond that truth that you were taught. Wow. He was a master at that, you guys.
Wow, that's almost, I mean, the one way to look at that is to have children and teach them that. That's a form of abuse to a certain extent, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean when I say it was, you know, emotional, psychological abuse. But of course, when you're in the midst of that, and I have no doubt in my mind that my father doesn't see it that way, but the reality is that's what it is. It locks people into place. It doesn't give you the opportunity to go out and search the world and make discoveries and be fascinated by the breadth and the width of the world and instead, you're locked in this fearful cocoon that you don't dare step out of, right?
Right, right. So is that what, when you first left away from him and away from the church, did you still consider yourself a Christian or a believer, or had you abandoned it over time, being away from him and finding out new stuff?
Yeah, there was a part of my brain that had accepted my father's, how do I say it, his
indoctrination?
Yeah, and his notion, or him, you know, who he said I was, you know, mm-hmm. I was the son of Belial, that I was, you know, damned to hell, and so I remember having the very conscious thought, you know, when I was 16, 17 years old, that, okay, that's who I am, that's the reality, that's inescapable. So I will go out and I will live my life on my terms, and I'll deal with that way down the road when I'm old, when I'm 40. For me, 40 was old, okay? And I remember having that thought. And then there was another part of me that thought, it's just nonsense. It can't be. So that's the part that I've always said is what kept me going, what kept hope floating, if you will, mm-hmm. was continuing the stubborn certainty that there's another truth out there. There has to be.
Right.
And, you know, spending most of my adult life searching for it, continuing to search for it.
Right. So Nate, you have siblings who have left the church. Now you left at 18 years old. Am I correct?
Yeah, the night I turned 18.
Okay. Now,
wow.
What was going through your head? I mean, why did you decide to leave in that fashion? I mean, I understand you kind of planned it as a getaway where you were going to leave on your 18th birthday.
Yeah. See, I mentioned earlier that Mark had left. My older brother Mark had left a few years earlier, and you know, I one of the things that you learn in a dangerous environment is you learn to be observant. You're reading the landscape constantly, and so I became a master at observing the world around me and making sure, you know, I knew where the dangers were and what I needed to do to be safe. So I watched my father and his behavior and his reaction to my brother Mark leaving, and Mark became this villain. You know, my father was preaching constantly about how evil he was and that anybody left and nobody could have anything to do with him, and if any of you others decide that you're going to abandon the faith, you know, you can go wallowing in that mud if you want to as well. So then I saw my older sister Catherine try to leave when she was 17 years old, and he physically went out. We filled two cars with the kids and went to where she was living and forced her into the car and forced her home, and he locked her in a room upstairs, and he beat her viciously for 3 or 4 months.
Wow.
Forced her into a fast. So I saw both sides of that. You know, what happens when you leave and he still has power over you, and what happens when you leave when he doesn't. So I knew that I wasn't about to leave before I was 18, but I also knew I wasn't going to stay a moment longer once I could legally be gone. So
Wow. That
was kind of the backdrop, and then I started making the plan and went out and bought a used, beat-up old car and kept it hidden up the street and slowly packed all my stuff and hid it away in the garage. And then on the night of my 18th birthday, once everybody had gone to sleep, I packed up the car and stood at the bottom of the stairs in the living room and waited for the clock to hit midnight. And then I was gone.
Wow. Wow. Man. It's like escaping from Alcatraz.
<That's right.
laughs> Wow.
That's I know I didn't have that type of, do you agree, Nate, that growing up in Kansas is already a kind of a fundamentalist place to grow up and be a Christian? It's kind of, it's a really religious place in my opinion. Do you get the sense have that same opinion?
Absolutely, and that was one of the things that acted as a force against my efforts to seek out the truth, because even though it wasn't nearly as extreme, the environment we lived in was fairly conservative and fairly staid in its religious ideology. So, you know, I'm kicking against a pretty solid trend you know, going out and looking for some other truth than the one that existed there in Kansas.
Right. So after you left when you were 18, Nate, how long did it take you to finally leave religion? Were you somewhat religious afterwards? Did you stay believing, and how did you deal with that?
Well, yeah, because like I said before, I was so anxious and so nervous and so certain that, you know, God hated me and waiting for the, you know, his hammer to come down. You know, that was one of the things that several of my other siblings left also, you know, when they were able to at 18. But then something would happen in their environment, and we grew up, you know, believing that if we left that our safety was, you know, God's, the security of God was lifted and he was going to punish us. So as soon as something bad would happen, everybody would rush back home. So there was this kind of thinking going on in your head, and I didn't want anything to do with religion. I was scared of it. So I stayed away from it for about 5 years. And then I met a gal and we got married and had moved to this beautiful, pristine new town at the base of a mountain in Southern California. And everything was perfect. And I made the decision that I was going to, where we lived a life of exclusion or exclusivity growing up. I decided I was going to immerse my kids in the society and make sure that they felt like they belonged. So one of those steps was to join a church there. I wasn't, you know, profoundly religious, but I thought that's something I needed to do to give them a right. sense of society and culture and right. social connection and that kind of thing. So that got me, you know, reconnected to the message of the Bible, but it was a more more mainstream, God loves everybody kind of message. And I'm constantly hearing my father's words in the background, you know,
right.
That I'm just fooling myself and that I'm heading down, you know, an evil path. And anyway, so I stayed connected to it, started asking more and more questions of the people that I got close to and during that period of my life. And you know, just came to the point after literally, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of going to the people I respected the most who I thought could give me answers and could really prove to me that this was all real, as well as praying constantly for God to open my eyes, right? I'm doing all the right things, reading all the books, and nothing. I just, you know, I couldn't get away from the idea that it's all contrived. And so
It wasn't the same for you anymore. Is that what you're saying? It didn't have the same kind of magic to it.
Yeah, there just wasn't anything. I couldn't. There was a better way in my mind to explain the world than to invoke a supernatural, invisible being. That made more sense to me. So that's kind of where I went. And I remember the last couple of years, I was attending a church Southern California, and this guy that was the pastor of the church, he's actually the son, the rebel son of one of the more successful, popular ministers out there in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And he was a philosopher, and I really enjoyed his, you know, the way he presented his ideas, so I would listen to him Sunday in and Sunday out and was just literally weeping at the end of these sermons.
Wow.
And I couldn't understand what it was. I didn't know if I was actually starting to have a spiritual experience or what. And it finally came to me that I realized I had quit living the myth and that I was letting go. That was a period of time that I was finally letting go of it all. And it's a beautiful thing. I mean, if you could just encompass the love and the community and the ideals of that are attached to Christianity,
right, right.
But let go of the mythology of Christianity. That's a beautiful right. thing, right?
Absolutely.
So it felt like I was having to give up something valuable in order to be true to myself.
And did it come to a certain point where you began to realize that you didn't necessarily need the mythology to still feel that sense of love and common unity with a community of people?
Yeah, it certainly that's exactly where I've gone, and I'm very comfortable with that. I mean, there's still questions that I struggle with, you know, because
yeah.
Christianity gives us an answer to what happens when we die.
Right.
It makes us feel better about that. But, again, I can't deceive myself, so I have to come to terms with what that implies. If we don't know, then we don't know, and it could very well be that when we die, it's the end. And
right.
that's a difficult thing to come to terms with, but it doesn't mean that we therefore accept a lie.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
as far as the other things, you know, when people talk about spirituality with me, when I try to explain my notion of spirituality, mm-hmm. it fits quite comfortable for me to say that there are experiences in our lives where we have such profound emotional responses to them
right.
that we want to call it something more than just emotion. And I get that. I've had them, you know, when my children were born. That was spiritual, okay?
Right, right.
But it doesn't have to be a God. It doesn't have to be a, you know, something out there that we have to invoke that we can't prove.
Right. It's accepting life on life's terms. And being comfortable with that, I definitely get it.
Just so.
Now, were you still a believer around 91? This is, I understand around 91 is when the church started what they're famous for, that God Hates Fags campaign. Is that, am I right? Is that around the time they started that?
Yeah, 1991. So you're literally talking about a generation now that has grown up with that campaign.
Yeah.
It's a 20-year anniversary this year. And I was, it's interesting you asked that question, because in 91, that was when I was doing some serious soul searching. And first Iraq war happened. And that knocked me for a loop winding, because kind of put it out there that we live in a dangerous world, potentially dangerous world, and made it more important that I come to terms with and find answers that I could live with.
Huh. That's, do you still, I wonder, do you ever come across, or any of the events that you're at, do you ever come across any of your siblings? Are they at some of these events? Do they come, and have you seen them? Or?
Yeah, I've seen them a couple times. Actually, I was back in Topeka speaking in April of last year. Mm-hmm. And they put on one of their big pickets, and I'm convinced to this day that it was for my benefit.
Wow.
It was for you, just because you were there.
Wow.
Yeah, because on the one hand, their official response is, he's irrelevant, he's of the devil, we're not going to give him the time of day. But they went out of their way to do that event after they did a three-hour interview with a documentary crew that was following me around. And made a point of telling them that they were going to be there, and some of their signs were clearly for my benefit. So Margie actually came across the street and called me to task for one of the assertions that I make that she was offended by, because they're all like our father. Most of them are very intelligent people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks, they just can't understand, because they want to imagine that a group of people who stand out and hold up signs that are so hateful, they must be inbred. There must be something mentally wrong with them. And that's just not the case for the most part, right?
Go ahead. I was just thinking that the other day. I was like, most of these, your siblings are lawyers. These are very smart people. And your father's, he's definitely a smart guy. How did people get to these beliefs, in your opinion? How do you go so far that?
Well, it's interesting, because I just read a book recently by this guy named Michael Shermer. He's the editor of Skeptic Magazine.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him, yeah.
And in this book, I think Why Do People Believe Weird Things is the title of the book, but he added a chapter in his most recent version of it. It basically answers the question, why do smart people believe weird things? And the essence of his answer is that it isn't the intelligent aspect of our brain that can lead us down a path of weird beliefs, but it is our intelligent aspect of our brain that allows us to defend those weird beliefs once we grab a hold of them.
Wow.
So we're not immune to it just because we're intelligent, So that's kind of the essence of what he argues there. But yeah, Margie had come across. She was upset with me because I have said all along that when you really consider the concept of choice, that in order for there to be true choice made available to someone, they have to first of all know what the choices are, mm-hmm. and they have to be free to choose any one of those without coercion.
Right.
And of course, it's unlikely you'll ever find a pure situation where you can choose anything and there is no consequence. But the point is that it's on a continuum, and the further you get away from that ability to choose freely without some horrific consequence, the further you get away from the idea that you ever had a choice. And I basically say they never really did have a choice. Because to choose to defy our father's theology is to give up everything including your eternal salvation, your eternal soul, in their minds. So, nonsense. There's no way in the world that they could argue that they have made that choice freely. And she was offended by that.
Wow. Yeah, that's kind of tough. Now, your mom, we don't really hear too much about your mom. I understand she's still an active member of the church, is that right?
Yeah, as I understand it, yeah.
Okay. How was that growing up? What did your mom ever have to say about it? Did she ever try to step in and change things? Do you think she fully agrees with your father's theology? And
I don't. Unfortunately, I can't say that I know what my mother's thinking was early on. I don't think that she ever really had much choice once she married my father. She was, you know, the way I basically describe it is that she was as much a victim as any of the children were. She made efforts in some instances to step in when he was excessively violent, and that as often as not led to violence against her. And, you know, that coupled with the highly misogynistic attitude of espoused in Calvinism, so women are second-class citizens anyway. Mm-hmm. So it really didn't matter what my mother thought. She was going to be in subjection to my father, and that was the end of the discussion.
And, Nate, you have children right now yourself?
Yeah, I have three kids and two stepchildren.
Okay, yeah. And how do you when they ever ask about their grandfather, how do you deal with that?
You know, we didn't burden them with that when they were growing up, and you know, I'll talk to them when they ask about it, and here in the recent past, probably the last 12 to 18 months, because of the visibility of my family as well as the things I'm doing, they've become more aware of it, and you know, we've talked about it in general, but I don't get too much into the specifics of it. But it was
right,
like growing up back there.
Okay, I heard you on another program. You had mentioned that you kind of agree with me in the sense that as long as we, as a society, make it okay to have these beliefs that aren't based on any kind of evidence, it kind of gives a little validity to your father and those like him in those type of churches.
Yeah, that's. See, it's always hard because when I go out and talk to people, they get more or less offended, depending on how strongly they hold their own faith, when I say that I have let go of it, that I just don't accept it anymore. I generally get somewhat of a pass because, you know, they're kind because of the violence that I grew up with, and I, right. I don't know how I feel about that, but what I try to say to people is that I don't have qualms about the social aspect of religion. I don't have problems with the love and the charity and the positive elements that religion brings to the world. Mm-hmm. But I do have problems with invoking a supernatural myth to explain the world. Because as soon as we go down that road, as soon as we say we can suspend logic, suspend reason, mm-hmm. to draw conclusions about how the world is, then we give permission for everyone to do that. And we can't judge this particular myth as being more or less valid than this myth, because there are no rules once you abandon the rules of reason and logic.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's do you feel like religion does more harm than good? I mean, because it's kind of hard to separate the two, the myths from it's, that's not mainstream religion. You have some, you know, who consider themselves to be spiritualists and they can separate the two, but the majority of the religious followers in our country, that's not how they view it. Do you think it's it does more bad than good?
Yeah, it's tough to say. It's done an awful lot of bad. I think most mainstream Christians consider themselves, that, you know, they're Christians because they want to be good. They want to be considered law-abiding and kind and gentle, and there have been a lot of families raised, a lot of people who have been solid, loving, valuable members of society who embraced an idea of God. But when you get to the hierarchy, to the authority, the power of Christianity, or the power that people invoke in the name of God, they can do horrible things to the masses. And, you know, it's a tough one to answer, because if I say to a Christian, Christianity has done terrible evils in this world, they're deeply offended by that, because they embrace this message of love, you know, that Christ was love, and, you know, that they're doing this because they're good. And how can you say that about something that I believe in? But facts are facts.
Yeah. Right. Now, in your kids, Nate, have you pretty much kept them away from religion? How are you raising them to be free thinkers? Or?
Well, like I said earlier, I you know, put them in Sunday school when we first moved out there to Santa Margarita, Rancho Santa Margarita. And, you know, so they grew up their first 4 or 5 years. And then when one Christmas time, my oldest boy, Tyler, had asked me about, you know, we were singing Christmas carols in the car, and he asked me about Jesus. And I made the mistake of thinking I could tell him about it, but leave them with a positive impression.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the midst of telling the story, and Tyler asked me, well, what about those people who don't believe? And I said, well, the Bible says that they go to hell. And he said, well, how long is that? I said, for eternity. And he said, well, what's eternity? I said, well, that's forever. And he just burst into tears. He was terrified. He said, I want to believe. He's crying. I want to believe. I don't want to go to hell. And the twins were in the back seat with him, and they're crying. And I'm sitting there like, what in the world have I done here, right? So I get home and I'm talking to my wife about it. I said, I'm not gonna do this to them anymore. I'm not gonna subject them to this kind of mythology. You know. So I basically at that point turned into an advocate for critical thinking.
Hmm.
And I challenged them. You know, they'd come home with something that they'd learned at school, and I would challenge them on it. I just constantly asking them questions. Well, how do you know that? You know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, I did some damage, in my opinion, but I tried to correct it, and I think that they've turned out pretty good.
Okay, good. That's good to hear. And you know, Nate, your story, like I said earlier, it's interesting, because you could just sit back and, you know, not have anything to do with it, but you've chose to take this stance and speak out against religion and tell your story, which I think that's great, because people need to hear it, because there's people out there who didn't come from the type of background you did, but they're still fearful. And I think that gives a lot of confidence to people. It's very inspiring. Why do you do it?
Well, I think for that very reason. I started out quite by accident, and suddenly I have people who are, you know, tearfully recounting their experiences growing up in a similar environment, or an environment that was completely different but left them with the same scars, and people who didn't necessarily grow up in a negative environment, but they're fearful of expressing, you know, these same ideas that, I just don't know. This doesn't make sense to me, but I don't dare say it because it's going to cost me dearly.
Right.
So there's a lot of different people, and, you know, the homosexual community, I can't tell you this, the letters I've gotten from people terrified at the thought that they are the cause of so much suffering in the world, like my father suggests. And so it's making a difference, you know. And I wasn't so insightful to have recognized that ahead of time, but once I realized it, I felt like it's something that I needed to do.
And it's definitely needed. One thing I've noticed is that even people who didn't grow up in as strict of an environment as you, there's still a social price to pay.
Yes.
When you have the vast majority of people who accept a particular worldview, and you really don't buy into it. And if you express it, it's almost as though they put shackles on your ability to have freedom of speech. And I think a lot of what you talk about here is important for people to hear it, because if someone that came from the environment that you came from could raise themselves up out of that environment and then begin to embrace critical thinking and the examination of claims critically, then I think that almost anyone can do it.
Yeah, and that's what I hope. I really do.
So what at this point in your life, you do a lot of lecturing?
Well, I'm doing some of that. I actually am working as the director, executive director of an organization called Center for Inquiry.
Okay.
Up here in Calgary, and they're actually started down in the States. They're a fairly good sized organization out of by Buffalo, New York. Have branches all over the country, and basically that's what they do. They go out there and they promote critical thinking and skepticism and free thought and humanism, and basically go out there and challenge the conventional wisdom or, you know, the mainstream thinking and force people to think about this kind of stuff. We actually started a campaign up here in Canada back in December called the Extraordinary Claims Campaign, based on Carl Sagan's famous quote that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Yes.
And it's stirred quite a controversy up here. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you been at certain lectures and had people who disagree with you and or members of the Westboro Baptist Church at those things heckling you?
No, haven't had that, and honestly don't expect that I ever will again, because they want to pretend like officially I'm irrelevant. So
yeah.
They will go out of their way to do that. So
except for when you come to Kansas.
Yeah, I don't worry too much about that. But if it happens, you know, I'm more than willing to confront them. I'm not going to go out of my way to cause a. I mean, why would I want to debate them?
Exactly.
I have a really good idea of what they believe, and I'm not going to say anything that's going to change their mind, and vice versa. So this thing that I'm doing isn't for those who are absolutely convinced that they're right. This is for people who are willing to consider the possibilities, ones who are closer to the middle, who are questioning, I want to present them with an alternative to consider.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mainly go after, you mainly speak your audience are people who's already questioning. You don't really try to get people to begin questioning, but you're there for those who have started to.
Yeah, I tell my story, and you had asked a question earlier, your previous question. I don't think I answered completely. I've had people challenge me, and I'm fairly gentle about it. I don't want to get into a big fight with them, but I'm not going to say that they're right or that I have changed my mind, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, if you can present evidence that, to me, a real critical thinker, a real skeptic is someone who says, the best evidence right now suggests that this is the truth. When you can come up with additional evidence, I am always open to change my mind. I love to change my mind. Nothing would make me happier than to discover that there was a God and that there was something after all of this. Right. I would embrace it in a heartbeat. There just isn't any evidence for it.
Right. Are there any books, specific books that you read during the time that you were coming into this awakening that really inspired you and really opened your eyes to a lot of different things?
Well, yes, it's interesting you ask that because, you know, I would spend hours, I was constantly, my mind was working on ideas and I would develop my own thoughts, but didn't dare talk about it to anybody. And then one day I picked up a book called The Science of Good and Evil again, interestingly enough, by Michael Shermer. I had never heard of Michael Shermer at that point, but the book title sounded interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading that book, and it's just like literally I had this awakening. I was freaking my wife out and my mother-in-law because they had both started moving towards Christianity, especially my mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading them these passages, and look, this just makes sense. It's what I've been saying. It's what I'm thinking, right?
Right.
And they're like going, oh, boy. So we got a problem here. But, I mean, I was it's like it woke me up. I was just, it was intense. You know, I know I'm not explaining this well, but it really resonated with me. And that's one of the moments I point to. And then, you know, when I moved up here to Canada and I was in the midst of this deep depression after my divorce, and my fiance gave me this book, you know, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. And again, so much of what he argued in that book was stuff that I had thought all along. I just hadn't, for one reason or another, hadn't articulated it and really formed the thoughts, you know, they hadn't coalesced well in my mind. So, you know, and then there's just a lot of other material out there. But what folks need to understand and what I explain to them, because so many people say, well, you just believe that because that's what you're reading. No. You got to understand, I spent years, I went into counseling. I spent 9 months with a guy who had a degree in theology and psychology. Mm. You know, he put me through the first 2 years of any theological degree program as far as the books he made me read. I was reading biblical hermeneutics. I was immersed in that stuff. I had to find answers, right? So it isn't a matter of me just, you know, partitioning myself off and only reading the stuff about skepticism and humanism. You know, I know what the Bible teaches. I know what Christianity believes.
Right.
So
basically it was equal time. What you were given was equal time with reading the skeptical material.
Yeah, I'd have to read for another 10 years, nothing but skeptic books to even things out. That's the reality of it.
Right. And you mentioned Richard Dawkins. What is your opinion of the new atheist movement? Now, some people say they're too hard, they're too critical, they're about the same as the religious. So what's your opinion on it?
Well, the whole notion that atheism is a religion is just nonsense to me. I think that any time that someone pushes back any prevailing idea, when you get pushback, you're going to get a lot of rhetoric and noise out there. But to me, guys, that's what it is. It's noise, because when you get right down to it, there's some basic, simple questions. Is there a God or isn't there? That's a simple question. When people start attacking and calling people names and saying that they're too strident or that it's really a religion in itself, that doesn't answer anything. It doesn't address the salient, critical questions that this whole thing's about. And it kind of drives me crazy at times, because I think, you know, I can read article after article and come away with absolutely no new information or no new understanding, because all it is people calling people names.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't serve any purpose. So I think Dawkins, do I think Dawkins has it all right? No.
Right.
I don't think it's possible to have it all right. I think that he came out and had the courage to suggest that there's another way to look at this, and I'm not going to back down from it anymore, and that upset a lot of people. He raises some legitimate points that should be discussed in the cold light of day, as does Chris Hitchens and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and, you know, some of these other writers out there. So there's a lot of good information. When you get away from all of the rhetoric and the name-calling, there's a lot to be discovered and understood, and that's how I look at it. I don't necessarily see it as the this particular group is more strident. What I do think is happening is there's a new swell, an upswell in people's willingness to consider the possibility that there isn't a God out there.
Right. Do you think it's maybe fear? The fact that they have fear of questioning certain assumptions that they were taught. And then when they see someone like yourself who speaks out about it, or someone like Dawkins who actually speaks out about it, do you think that maybe it's fear? It's the entire fear of punishment.
Yeah, I do. I think fear is always a strong catalyst here. In fact, one of the we screened a film called Flight from Death here at the Center for Inquiry back in December, and it talks about that very point that one of the things that motivates humans, one of the core motivations of humans, is that they're so traumatized by the knowledge that their existence will end. You know, we as conscious creatures are the only entities on the earth that can live day in and day out with the certainty that one day we will die, and that creates such fear in us at a subconscious level that we invest ourselves deeply in these social systems that eases that anxiety, and so invested in it that when someone comes along and challenges it, there is a visceral reaction of hatred and antipathy against that person or that group. And that's why people fight wars, because they're fearful of death. So it's all about fear. It's an interesting philosophy, and they've actually done some science to that that they talk about in that film called Flight from Death. If you get a chance to see it, it's fascinating.
Okay.
Well, I do appreciate you coming on the show today, Nate. And hopefully we can have you back on here again and keep doing what you're doing out there. Is there anything that you are involved in right now? I heard you say the organization that you currently work with. Is there any upcoming lectures that you're giving or any talks that you have coming up?
Well, I'm trying to get more and more involved in advocating for the LGBT community. And so that's kind of a long-term goal. As well as what I'm doing with the Center for Inquiry, I'm actually going to be in Clayton, Missouri, which is just outside of St. Louis. I think it's the 10th of March.
10th of March.
Yeah, and then I'm going to be speaking at a Imagine No Religion conference in British Columbia in May. Those are the two specific events that are scheduled right now. Beyond that, I'm just continuing to work on this book and doing this work with the Center for Inquiry.
Okay, great. Well, you have to let me know when you're, remind me of when you're going to be in Clayton. I'll show up. Definitely
Alrighty.
Want to see that.
You betcha.
Okay.
All right, guys. All thank right. you very much.
Thank you, Nate. You're a real inspiration.
Thanks, Jason. You take care.
All right. Well, you've been listening to The Skeptic Hour. That was our guest, Nate Phelps. Hopefully we can have Nate back on the show. I do thank everybody for listening and tuning in. We'll be back on March 6th, where we'll be interviewing Donald Wright and his new book, The Only Prayer I'll Ever Pray Is Let My People Go. Until then, you've been listening to The Skeptic Hour. Have a good evening and question everything.